In the hot, sticky August of 2017, a select group of the world's leading behavioural scientists gathered in Chicago. Their task? To tackle some very ancient questions with some very modern tools. What is wisdom? Can it be measured? And critically, how do we develop it? Boarding a plane with microphone in hand, I went to Chicago to find answers to these questions, to pick the brains of these wise experts, and to hit the city streets to learn what the people of Chicago have to tell us about living wisely in the modern world.
What you go through, you know what I'm saying, and you learn from it, that's what makes you wise.
You know, it's sad, but a lot of times going through more difficult things are what lead people, it can go either way. Going through difficult things leads people to closing off more, or it leads people to opening their perspectives.
At a point when wisdom in public life seems more essential than ever, the emerging field of wisdom research aims to uncover the science of how the internal mechanics of wisdom actually work, how we might take wiser decisions in our personal lives, and how we might even build a wiser society.
More people are jumping on board with the study of wisdom from different disciplines. And I think that's because of the world we live in and the problems we face. People are recognizing that smart people, smart leaders, are getting us into trouble. Smart leaders aren't making wise decisions.
If you don't believe in gender equality, just believe this. It will make you wiser to have more women on board.
Our technological capacities are advancing far faster than some of our other capacities. And so we have a desperate need for practical wisdom in this world today, and we don't have a lot of time to figure that out.
For centuries, wisdom has been the preserve of philosophy and religion and has lacked rigorous definition. In the Buddhist tradition, it's framed as the distinguishing of thoughts and deeds that contribute to authentic happiness from those that destroy it. Christians, meanwhile, describe wisdom as profound understanding of life granted by God. Over the last 40 years, however, wisdom has begun to make its way into science departments across the globe. Psychologists are finding that societies do share an agreed understanding of wisdom, and beyond that, they're finding the pursuit of knowledge without wisdom doesn't seem to provide us with the answers that we're looking for. Here's behavioral neuroscientist Greg Norman from the University of Chicago.
I think in the past it wasn't focused on as much in the scientific literature because there wasn't this much of a tension or a pressing need for the dissociation between knowledge versus wisdom, and I think now people might be paying more attention because everyone that's really collecting data on a large scale is running into this problem, whether we're talking about molecular biology all the way up to kind of, you know, population surveys. It's the same problems repeating itself, and something like wisdom is going to come into play and figure out what to do with it.
My background's in physics, so I very much believe in the pursuit of knowledge, mostly leaving talk of wisdom to the philosophers. If something can't be measured, my eyes rapidly glaze over and I become a little skeptical. But what if something as valuable as wisdom can be measured? Might a scientific understanding of wisdom help us make better decisions in our personal lives, and maybe even help us build wiser societies? I've recently become more and more fascinated by this prospect, and according to Heather Harden-Mangelsdorf, a doctoral candidate at the University of Chicago, wisdom most definitely merits this growing scientific attention.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with our current kind of social and political times, right? Our country seems increasingly divided, and it seems like there's a lot of growing social issues that as a society we're trying to solve. And so this seems like a particularly good time to think about wisdom and particularly educating the next generation to hopefully become wiser and make wiser decisions and kind of wiser in their social interactions and relating to each other.
The Fall and Rise of Wisdom is an enlightening tale. In the ancient world, wisdom was considered the pinnacle of human experience. Philosophers, lovers of wisdom, considered it the path to a meaningful life. The scientific revolution of the 18th century saw our greatest thinkers embrace the study of things that can be measured, and wisdom was largely left to the philosophers. As psychology then sought to establish itself as a serious scientific discipline in the 19th century, intangible internal constructs such as wisdom were once again left behind, a process that continued with behaviorism until the mid-20th century. Wisdom, once humanity's most valued prize, was now many steps removed from science.
In the wisdom literature that goes back to the early days of humankind, you will find that wisdom is reserved for a few. in a given society.
In the mid-1950s, the cognitive revolution had reclaimed the study of mental processes. The growth of social psychology, and later behavioral economics, allowed for the study of what might constitute wise behavior, managing uncertainty and risk, considering multiple perspectives, judgment and decision making. Wisdom was being approached once again, though cautiously from the edges. In the late 1970s, psychologists started to ask new questions. Do we continue to develop after reaching adulthood? Is aging only about decline, or might some facilities actually bloom in the autumn years? Is there a peak state that humans grow towards over the course of their lives? These questions led to the completion of the circle. Wisdom was back on the agenda. It was wisdom's return from the wilderness.
Most generally, I think that wisdom is a rare and extraordinary form of human development. I think more specifically that I would view wisdom as a body of experience-based knowledge concerning human life and living, how to live.
A team in Berlin did the first empirical work on wisdom in the early 1980s, defining wisdom as expertise in the fundamental pragmatics of life. Their careful and extensive early work, led by Paul Bountes, laid the scientific groundwork for the new field. Leading intelligence expert Robert Sternberg, meanwhile, was frustrated with our educational systems and soon added the should aspect to wisdom, suggesting that wisdom involved harnessing intelligence for the common good. Soon afterwards, Monica Ardelt took this further, suggesting that wisdom involved the interaction of not just reflective and cognitive components, but also a compassionate dimension.
You often got a little bit of a, well, that sounds very new agey, which doesn't seem to be the case anymore. So wisdom research has really increased its reputation.
In 2007, the University of Chicago launched the first of a series of large-scale programs to support and disseminate wisdom research at an international level. Here's Margaret Plouzogan from University of Virginia's School of Medicine.
I think we're also making so much progress in neuroscience and in the science of emotion that studying these difficult, messy topics like love and compassion and how we think don't feel quite so impossible as they did maybe 20 years ago.
Once a year, leading researchers from across the globe gather in Chicago to continue charting this new landscape and lay the foundations of an emerging new field. I became fascinated by the field of wisdom research in 2015 and had been doing my bit to share the research as widely as possible ever since. But I still had many questions. If I wanted answers to these questions, it was time to board a plane to Chicago.
Welcome aboard our flight to Chicago. O'Hare International Airport should be departing the gate shortly. Looks like everything's running according to schedule, so...
Arriving in downtown Chicago, I felt an immediate smack of recognition. The city has a rich and lively history, home to both Barack Obama and Al Capone. And for anyone familiar with the new Batman films, you can't escape the feeling that you are walking into the heart of Gotham City.
Who's wise? I think a guy who made up Uber and Lyft is pretty wise. That's a good idea. I wish I did it. We're not supposed to do this and drive. This is illegal.
Today, Chicago is at the cutting edge of a new frontier of science. Following the launch of the Defining Wisdom Project in 2007 and the Wisdom Research Project in 2012, the University of Chicago opened the Center for Practical Wisdom in 2015, the first of its kind in the world.
I'm Howard Nussbaum. I'm a professor of psychology at the University of Chicago, and I'm the director of the Center for Practical Wisdom.
The stated aim of the center is to understand how to gain, reinforce, and apply wisdom in order to help create wiser individuals, institutions, and societies. The center now hosts the field's pioneers once a year at its annual Wisdom Research Forum, and it was this gathering that had drawn me to Chicago. The evening before the forum began, I sat down with the center's director, Howard Nussbaum. I was intrigued to know what it was like to work in such a new field.
What reaction do you get when you tell people, if you meet them at a dinner party, and say, what do you do, and you say that you study wisdom? How does that normally go over?
What I typically get is curiosity and interest. People are interested in wisdom, and I think they're interested in it because I usually start with this contrast that there's a difference between being smart and being wise, and that really is goes back to Bob Sternberg and others.
Researchers frequently point out that wise people are typically smart, but smart people are not necessarily wise. In psychology, they would say intelligence is necessary but not sufficient for wisdom. This implies that somehow wisdom sits above mere intelligence, which resonates with many people's intuitions about wisdom. Other research indicates that intelligence can be used to promote selfish interests, whilst wisdom employs intelligence in pursuit of the common good. It only takes a quick review of the notorious Enron scandal to conclude that the difference between intelligence and wisdom is in fact quite stark. I asked Professor Nussbaum for a heads up on what I could expect to witness when the world's leading wisdom researchers gather in one room.
So at this particular meeting, one of the things we're going to talk about is that notion of wisdom impact. What can wisdom research do to affect things in the world? And to talk about wisdom research and education. Those conversations are also important.
The Center for Practical Wisdom was launched with a large investment from the John Templeton Foundation. I was interested to know what hopes the foundation had for the field and what it was about wisdom itself that had captured their attention. Here's Barnaby Marsh from the foundation on the phone from New York.
I think there's tremendous public interest in wisdom, yet it's very difficult to define. Scholars around the world, including scientists, have been building our store of knowledge and understanding, but it's not clear that we're becoming wiser as a result. And that's one of the things that prompted us to make this big investment in new wisdom research.
At this point, there are three big questions facing the researchers. How do you define wisdom? How do you measure wisdom? And how can you develop wisdom? After chatting with Howard Nussbaum, I retired to my room for the evening. Looking at the program for the next day's activities, I see presentations titled, Wise But Unhappy, Can Wisdom Be Enhanced? And Wisdom, Balance and Bias. If I was going to find answers to these questions anywhere, it seems it would be here, in the city of Chicago. Arriving at the forum, there is a palpable buzz in the air as old friends and young researchers sign in and pour themselves much-needed coffee. Delegates' name tags reveal that we are in the presence of psychologists, yes, but also sociologists, doctors, and even neuroscientists. I found myself a seat, and sipping my coffee, I thought once again of my big questions. Before wisdom can be studied, it has to be defined. So my first task was clear: to get a grip on how researchers define wisdom. So, what actually is wisdom?
One way of defining wisdom is to see it as a psychological strength that emerges relatively late in life, and that involves not only cognition, but affect, intuition, morality, and a bunch of other parts of human psyche. So it's not unidimensional, but multidimensional.
That was Masami Takahashi, professor of psychology at Northeastern Illinois University. Now, this is most definitely not the only definition of wisdom. Different researchers have different working definitions, which can be frustrating. Nonetheless, there are a number of themes that seem to be fairly consistent amongst definitions when characterizing wise behavior. Wise people have a facility for integrating intelligence with emotion, considering a broad range of perspectives, navigating uncertainty, and directing their efforts to the common good. There are, however, a number of fault lines within the field which are less easily reconciled.
There is a fairly solid, robust evidence that if men talk to women, they happen to maybe push down some of the egocentrism that is known to them when they talk to other men.
Meet Igor Grossman, director of the Wisdom and Culture Lab at the University of Waterloo in Canada. A rising star in the field of wisdom research, Grossman challenges the fundamental idea that some of us are just wise and some of us not. When it comes to wise behavior, he claims there is much more at play than simply our personality characteristics. There is also the power of the situation.
Wisdom is not an immutable entity. It's a process. What I mean by immutable entity is that people fall trapped to psychological essentialism. They
the tendency to reduce complex issues into clear-cut, or seemingly clear-cut categories. Yes or no, wise versus not wise. That's certainly true for wisdom. Our lay views about wisdom, if you ask somebody on the street quite often, unless you ask them about specific events, quite often people categorize individuals into wise versus not.
And neglecting the role of the situation, he claims, leads to us missing a key part of the wisdom puzzle.
So this form of essentialism, psychological essentialism, fails to account for the vast power of the situation or various contexts on person's behavior. After all, even the wisest person could sometimes act foolishly, and the foolish person under some circumstances, even though maybe rarely, might act wisely. And so in my work, for instance, I've argued for the critical importance of understanding the situation, situational conditions, promoting and inhibiting wisdom as a way to really start understanding and developing curricula, developing programs. And if we ignore this context, if we ignore the role of the situation, the power of the situation, we make ourselves blind for the super valuable lessons about how wisdom can be enhanced or how to develop it over time.
So Grossman suggests we ignore the context of wise behavior at our peril. Wisdom doesn't happen in a vacuum. And when trying to define wisdom, Takahashi was also keen to point out the importance of the very specific context we call culture. Might different cultures hold different conceptions of wisdom? Whilst Western ideas of wisdom focus on the role of thinking and harnessing intelligence for good ends, is this idea universal?
In the East, we don't really value written forms or even sometimes words, because words are cognitive representation, and that hinders sometimes the true thoughts. So instead of teaching pupils, wisdom is, masters say, just do it, experience it. So one is more cognition-based and one is more action or experience-based. So there are pros and cons to that.
I was fast learning that, despite broad agreement on several components, defining wisdom is no simple matter. I'd originally thought of wisdom as a character trait, but instead it seems to be more a product of both personality and the situation. Perhaps when trying to pin down wisdom, the conception of a wise person may be less helpful than the idea of a wise act. And whilst none of us might always be wise, it's encouraging to learn that all of us can be wise from time to time.
Okay, so the head of my program, Dr. Joel, I consider him wise because he comes at situations with multiple perspectives and always takes the time to consider all aspects of a question or all aspects of a situation. He never jumps to conclusions and he takes his time always so he can think things through as much as he thinks is possible. And I respect that because I think that allows you to connect to more people and understand more situations and be more empathetic. Someone I would consider not wise would be, I have a really good friend who makes decisions to sleep on sidewalks and, all the crazy college stuff. And so I don't think that's wise because it's like a level of maturity. I think wisdom comes with maturity, because the more immature a person is, I don't think they really can open their mind up to that, I guess.
Since I first learnt about the field of wisdom research, I had always been somewhat unsure about the idea of measuring wisdom. Wisdom just seemed too broad and diffuse to capture in a bottle. Do you take a wisdom exam? What if you don't pass? Can you really give someone a wisdom score? This question, how do you measure wisdom, is the second of the big questions researchers are grappling with. As you might expect with trying to wrangle something like wisdom, there are considerable challenges involved.
I think wisdom is related to satisfaction, because the wise people know or can be okay with whatever there is, with the acceptance. This is why I like this quote, the pass is easy for those who don't have any preferences.
The voice you just heard is Monica Ardelt. She is a leading pioneer in the field of wisdom measurement, most well known for her development of the three-dimensional wisdom scale. The scale is massively popular amongst researchers, who appreciate its simplicity and ease of administration. I caught up with Professor Ardelt just before the forum got underway, and she outlined some of the inherent difficulties in measuring wisdom.
That is exactly the challenge, how to measure wisdom, right? Because I think wisdom cannot be measured directly, but you can measure the components of wisdom. This is what I'm trying to do in the three-dimensional wisdom model. So you have the three components of wisdom, and I'm saying if people have the cognitive, reflective, and compassionate characteristics, personality characteristics, then they are more likely to be wise.
Her scale contains questions which aim to establish if you have the characteristics which make up the components of wisdom. In her framework, these components are cognition, reflection, and compassion. You can take the test yourself online in about 5 minutes. I did it myself and got 3.9 out of 5, a score categorized slightly disappointingly as relatively moderate wisdom. In carrying out large studies, this simplicity of administration is a distinct advantage. However, like with any measurement tool, the scale only measures wisdom if you agree with this definition of wisdom.
You know, we still have not a uniform definition of wisdom. We don't have a general agreed upon measure of wisdom. But a lot of people kind of agree that wisdom has a, you know, cognitive component, a knowledge component, a reflective component, looking at things from different perspectives. And I think a lot of people agree that there is a compassionate component.
The Center for Practical Wisdom has made sure that the Wisdom Research Forum is attended by scholars of many different stripes, allowing for these tough questions to be approached from many different angles. For example, neuroscientist Dilip Jesty.
I am Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry and Neurosciences and Senior Associate Dean for Healthy Aging at University of California, San Diego.
Jesty has tackled the question of wisdom from the perspective of biology rather than psychology or sociology. A comprehensive review of the wisdom research literature in 2009 led him to develop a neurobiological model of the wise brain. What exactly is going on in the brain when we're taking a wise decision? I was keen to hear Dr. Jesty outline his family model of the wise brain.
The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is like a proverbial father. It is disciplinary, punitive, it tells you what not to do, and it is strict about ensuring that you do what you have to do. On the other hand, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex is like a proverbial mother. She's kind, nice, helpful to others, and she teaches you not just to look after your interests, but also those of other people. They ask you to share your toys with your sibling and with your peers as well as the rest of the society. So one part is telling you to be self-centered, selfish, disciplined. Other part is telling you to be generous, kind, and helpful to others. Sometimes there is a conflict between these two perspectives. That is when we go to our uncle or aunt, that is the anterior cingulate, which detects conflicts and may help resolve them. And then amygdala is like the proverbial friend. You can always go to your friend whenever you want a shoulder to cry on or share your pleasures. And so wisdom really reflects balance among these different areas.
Whilst he is keen to stress, this is a considerable simplification of the workings of the brain. Jesty's work on the neurobiology of wisdom marks an important step in the evolution of the field. Jesty also reflected on some of the inherent limitations of wisdom scales that ask people to assess their own faculties.
At this time, the main way in which we can study wisdom is by doing rating scales, which have been quite reliable and validated. However, they are subjective. They ask the person about various questions and the person has to rate himself or herself on this question. So there is a question about social desirability bias, that people may make themselves look better than they are. One way you can get around it is by asking other people to rate you, but then also their biases come into play. So right now, we don't have an objective measure of wisdom.
We met Igor Grossman earlier in the program when he was urging us to not ignore the role of the situation in wise action. He also rings alarm bells about the potential paradoxes that might arise when asking people to rate themselves for wisdom.
And I imagine answering questions about your perspective-taking abilities. So, are you a good listener? Cool. What would a wise person say? A wise person would probably say, probably not. I mean, I can come up with a lot. If I were a wise person, I can come up with probably a lot of situations in which I was not a good listener, not enough. And that leads to a dilemma. In contrast, a person full of themselves would very likely indicate that they're a terrific listener.
Grossman argues strongly that wisdom cannot be measured by asking people to fill out self-report questionnaires regarding their abstracted personality characteristics, suggesting the results will be massively distorted by many types of biases. But he and his team have been working hard on a solution.
The idea is very simple. Let's take questionnaires, let's use questionnaires, but situate them in the context of concrete experiences rather than asking to report on abstract qualities. And when you want to do that, what you want to do is also ensure that you can avoid some memory biases. And here I had an insight from innovative research conducted by some of the best survey methodologists in the world, including Norbert Schwartz and the Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman, who proposed to avoid some of the memory recall biases by first reconstructing the context of the experience. So you recall the surrounding, the time, the people involved in the event, next recall your thoughts and feelings after you've done that. Now you're ready to really, you have a setting, the background, you're ready to answer the questions and you may be less prone to biases.
And this approach results in some interesting outcomes, including reducing the social desirability bias and getting us to perhaps be a little bit more truthful about our own behavior.
Turns out if you do that, it's easier also not to lie, because after all, you're thinking about a single incident instead of your personality or wisdom at large. So you're not as tempted to say, well, I was really fantastic in my abilities to perspective take in that particular moment, because you may just not think that this moment generalizes to everything.
So it seems that careful work in the labs of the University of Waterloo has yielded a valuable tool in the science of measuring wisdom.
Most critically, it helps you to think about the context. So we have finally a measure that can account for the context in an ecologically valid fashion, easy to administer.
Measuring wisdom is fraught with difficulty. Different definitions each require different associated measurement tools, meaning research findings are sometimes not as transferable as they might be if the same tools were used by all research teams. Beyond that, self-report scales, whilst popular and powerful, have their own limitations. New tools are emerging which aim to minimize some types of bias, and it looks like the measurement of wisdom is steadily moving onto solid ground.
I believe nowadays our generation, the newer generation, is being dumbed down by technology such as cellular phones. It's actually shocking to me. I know actually phones that are smarter than actually people nowadays. So as far as wisdom, I really don't see as much wisdom as I would probably say in the past. So I would definitely have to say my grandfather. He would always have some wise words and some very wise advice also.
The most important of the big questions has to be, how can we intentionally develop wisdom? This was the central question that had brought me to Chicago. Surely that's the point of all this research, after all. How do we actually become wiser? Fortunately, I was in a room with the people that knew more about the science of wisdom than anyone else in the entire world.
This decline in openness, the decline in purpose in life, the decline in a growth impetus is a decline in our maturation towards growth and becoming, you know, moving beyond ourselves, if you wish. grandiose, but that's what growth is. And that is actually what would lead us further towards wisdom. And currently what we observe is that with age this goes down rather than up.
Meet Ursula Staudinger, wisdom research trailblazer. As well as having done some of the very first empirical lab-based work on the science of wisdom in Berlin in the 1980s, she is now director of the Columbia Aging Center in New York. Staudinger's research suggests that at the heart of wisdom development is how we respond to life's inevitable challenges. There is the adjustment response, where we reframe a problem to make ourselves feel better. And there is the growth response, where we stare at the problem clear-eyed and learn the lessons that can be learned. And surprisingly, one approach alone is not sufficient. Both approaches have a role to play in developing wisdom over the course of our lives.
In our most recent data analysis, what we find in a longitudinal data set is that it seems to be the case that this movement towards adjustment provides an important launchpad for the potential for moving forward on growth. We found that one class of people, one type of people, did exactly that. They crisscrossed between moving forward on adjustment, moving forward on growth, and both profited towards, in the end, in later life, being higher on wisdom. Whereas the opposite group was like having an exclusive priority on adjustment, which is actually very much rewarded, because we may turn out to get a better salary. If we are more streamlined, if we are good to the boss, if, you know, we maybe get a raise, whereas the person who questions the boss may not be so easy getting a raise, and so forth. And so actually those people who prioritize adjustment and suppress growth, they have the least chances to come out with higher wisdom in late life.
Before letting Staudinger go, I had to ask her one final question. A question that had been turning over insistently in the back of my mind since I landed in Chicago. Wisdom had been cast out of the realm of serious academic inquiry for hundreds of years. What did she think was behind wisdom's return from the wilderness? What's going on in society right now that's reigniting our interest in this ancient and neglected concept? Her response gave me plenty to think about.
With globalization and the connection between different societies that results in a merging of value systems, of opportunities, how to lead your life. There are many options. With increasing living standards, we have lots of options, you know, which school to go to, which whatever. I mean, for every single bit in life, we now have a lot of choice, which wasn't the case in the past, and in certainly not in the beginning of the 20th century, before the two world wars. It was much more streamlined and a clearer pattern of what a good life was meant to be. And so the analysis of the philosophers was that it was due to this pluralization in options that more and more people looked for guidance and orientation. And wisdom through the millennia always had been turned to when there was a need for guidance and orientation. And so it seems that modern and postmodern and deconstructivist times, they more and more and more look for new guidance.
The modern world can be a confusing and sometimes overwhelming place. With traditional authorities holding less sway than in the past, we each find ourselves having to repose the question of how to live. But there are dangers in reaching too readily for certainty in an uncertain world. Populism and even terrorism can be viewed as reassuring oversimplifications, promising a return to simpler times.
Of course, one guidance that we can observe around the globe is fundamentalism. So some societies, groups in societies, do away with the anxiety and the uncertainty by returning back to clear-cut black and white and easy rules, but let's hope that the majority is still trying to embrace the plurality and find you know, make it such that it is easier for the individuals to find their path in the plurality.
The world's problems don't have clear answers, and that's the basic disconnect. You know, people are taught to perform well in very controlled situations. But the world is not like that at all. So who is developing the necessary skills to manage the world's dilemmas? No one.
This is Nick Westrate from the University of Toronto. I managed to catch up with him after he presented his latest research at the forum. A common view of wisdom is that we gain it by experiencing traumatic events. Whilst there is some truth in that, his work suggests this is not the whole story.
My research has shown that individuals who experience a high number of negative life events, if those people are to gain in wisdom, they need to reflect on those experiences in a deep and meaningful way. So that's a great synopsis of what my research has shown. My colleagues and I have called this type of self-reflection exploratory processing.
Exploratory processing gets at what Ursula Staudinger was referring to as growth response, not shying away from negative events, but analyzing them for lessons. So, is exploratory processing the key to becoming wiser? Should I be analyzing every negative event I experience for lessons as a fast track to wisdom? Well, it appears not. As Westrate explained, there's a time for learning lessons, and there's a time for perhaps just keeping your head above water.
I mean, I think that if people were in a perpetual state of exploration, they may not be very happy people. I think that, as I said, exploratory processing is hard work. The payoff over the long term might be very great in terms of something like the development of wisdom, which is correlated with well-being. But if you want to move on quickly and just protect yourself to gain or maintain your level of subjective well-being, something like redemptive processing, where you just turn a negative event into an emotionally positive one, may be more strategic for you.
From speaking to Staudinger and Westrate, it appeared that the road to wisdom was paved with dark events. I was glumly beginning to think that a life of trauma and tribulation was unavoidable, but Westrate reassured me this wasn't necessarily the case. His research has led him to the conclusion that it's less about whether an event is good or bad, and more about how much the event disrupts how you see the world.
I don't think it's about whether or not one is positive or negative. I think it is about whether or not an event shatters our expectations of life, as I had said. So it's about, other researchers have used the terminology, a shattering of the assumptive world. And I really like that, because when our expectations are disrupted, we need to engage in some sort of an integrative process that allows us to regain balance. And often what that means is that we need to replace our old sort of our worldviews and knowledge structures with new ones. And in most cases, or in many cases, those new structures are wiser structures because something about life has been unveiled, that disillusionment piece. We now have a clearer, deeper understanding of the human condition.
So beyond good events and bad events, wisdom development seems to depend upon experiencing disruptive events. These events then must be reflected on deeply, and lessons must be learned. And then maybe you're moving towards wisdom. With such a precise range of criteria, I was fascinated to ask a real wisdom researcher if he could actually think of anyone wise. I was both surprised and enlightened by his response.
Even though I do have that sort of expert knowledge, the person who keeps popping up in my mind is Yoda. And I mean, this just seems like a totally ridiculous answer, but in a way, Yoda is, he really conforms to the intellectual prototype of wisdom, the philosophical prototype of wisdom that my study had included, as well as the benevolent one. You know, he understood the underlying unity of all people. Wisdom is experience-based knowledge, but it is oriented toward the common good. And I think that wise people are very self-transcendent, and they understand that connection to people, to nature, and I think Yoda embodies that.
Having dug deeply into individual wisdom, I was wondering if societies more broadly could be made wiser. Might we introduce wisdom into schools and universities? Could students have not just their intelligence nurtured and celebrated, but their wisdom too? In the corner of the conference room sat Professor Robert Sternberg, a veritable titan of wisdom research. A former president of the American Psychological Association, he has in his time developed respected theories not only for wisdom, but also for intelligence, creativity, and even love. He has over 130,000 citations for his work on Google Scholar, and as you might expect from such a prominent figure in the field of wisdom research, he doesn't suffer fools gladly. Suffice to say, he knows a great deal about the science of wisdom and foolishness, and he is very much worried about the state of the world. Here's Sternberg responding to questions from the forum floor.
I think things are getting worse, and if we don't do something about it, we're really in trouble. The problem is it's really hard to get schools to change. It's really hard to get institutions to change. And, you know, the stock market is going up.
Sternberg has spent years encouraging schools and universities to stop focusing exclusively on intelligence and to start taking wisdom much more seriously. He even developed wisdom assessments for the college admissions process. In fact, he argues, an education system that creates leaders of great intelligence but little wisdom simply gets us into more trouble more quickly.
2 years ago, it might have sounded a little empty. Well, you know, he's just another Cassandra. But I think it's happening, and we may not have that much time. And, you know, it's frightening that, you know, Congress is doing nothing. Most people are doing nothing. We as academics are continuing to publish articles in journals as though nothing is going on. And I just think that if schools don't start selecting kids for wisdom and trying to develop wisdom and really doing something about it, we're in danger.
So had I finally got to the bottom of wisdom development, or was I none the wiser? Individually, wisdom seems to be a hard-won achievement. Research suggests that we can grow wiser from disruptive events if we reflect on them deeply, although this is best alternated with healthy doses of pragmatic reframing to keep our spirits high. In terms of nurturing wisdom at the level of society, many researchers propose the education system as the vehicle for developing wisdom more broadly, whilst pointing out it is a system that changes very slowly indeed. But one conclusion is crystal clear. As individuals and as societies, we need to start thinking of wisdom development less as an abstract aspiration and more as a practical priority.
Mental bumps and bruises, like going through trials and tribulations. I think that's what makes you wise. Yeah.
Learning from your mistakes. Learning from your mistakes can make, you know what I'm saying, make you much wiser than you think, you know?
With the conference coming to an end, I felt incredibly privileged to have taken a peek into the unfolding world of a new field of science. To witness psychologists, doctors, neuroscientists, and sociologists all bringing their 21st century expertise to bear on the ancient concept of wisdom was both fascinating and inspiring. Psychologist Anne Henley left me with a thought about the long historical arc of scientific inquiry. Following many years of necessary specialization into narrower and narrower disciplines, the direction of travel has now reversed. Scientists are now starting to weave their disparate knowledge back together in order to tackle the big questions. Questions like, what is wisdom? Questions bigger than any of them could handle alone.
In the field of language, people have made a move to thinking more generally, integrating across all these different areas. That's also true in psychology at large. People who did social psychology did not do cognitive psychology. Social cognition came about. And this is now currently happening with fields like religion. What is a psychological value kind of religious beliefs? And why would we have ever evolved such things? What function do religious beliefs serve in our society? And we know a lot about those things, attention, memory, knowledge, storing knowledge. How do we weave those together and apply them in a particular context for a particular purpose? So in psychology, we've started to do that more and more.
Such cross-disciplinary adventures inevitably result in some healthy differences of opinion. Nonetheless, consensus in the field does seem to be steadily emerging over what wisdom is, how to measure it, and even how it might be developed in individuals and societies. Here's the Centre's director, Howard Nussbaum, once again, with an eye to the future of wisdom research.
What has been the biggest surprise for you?
I think one of the biggest surprises is the degree to which people who are scientists have not resisted the notion of studying something that is big and relatively diffuse intellectually, as wisdom is, that people are ready to and excited to take hold of that challenge and try to come up with new ways of scientifically understanding wisdom. That there are more places thinking about wisdom scientifically than there have been in the past, and that we're starting to make progress in various ways. So people like Igor Grossman, who are developing new kinds of measures of wisdom, people who are willing to conceive of how to do the neuroscience of wisdom. Those are the most, interesting things that have grabbed hold of me as changes that are taking place, and I think that's where the future is.
As I bade farewell to Chicago and boarded the plane back to London, my mind turned to the wildly popular field of behavioural economics, a not-so-distant cousin of wisdom research. Once an esoteric discipline of interest only to a small number of academics, the field is now very much part of the public imagination. From what I'd witnessed in Chicago over the previous few days, wisdom research is very well positioned to make the same journey, bringing behavioural science to the service of helping people take wiser decisions in their daily lives. My Chicago quest had made one thing crystal clear. The scientific method, perhaps humanity's most effective tool, is now finally being brought to bear on wisdom, arguably humanity's most valued prize. This is a tantalizing proposition indeed. Furthermore, following years and years of perhaps necessary specialization, the future belongs to those who can weave our distinct and hard-won knowledge back together in order to answer our biggest questions. The future, it seems, belongs to the wise.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. American Airlines welcomes you to London, England. Local time is 6:20. On behalf of your entire Chicago-based flight crew, thank you for traveling.
To watch talks from the Wisdom Research Forum 2017, visit the Center for Practical Wisdom's YouTube channel. To learn more about wisdom research, visit the center's site at wisdomcenter.uchicago.edu. For further resources, animations, interviews, videos and articles, visit evidencebasedwisdom.com.